Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Justin Wilbury.
My name is Perry Mason Wilbury.
And we're live on tape from Tallahassee and Madrid. In 1988, the surprise word spread about a new supergroup, one that simultaneously did and did not trade off the fame of its participants. The Traveling Wilburys was made up of The Voice, The Lyricist, The Young Gun, The Producer, and most importantly, The Beatle, who seemed to be the one driving the entire enterprise. Over three decades later, the Traveling Wilburys seems to have gone down quite well in history and is remembered fondly. It's a curious junction in George's career, though, isn't it? Is it a surprising thing that he did the Wilburys?
I think so. I mean, if you put it in context, he's coming off the back of Cloud Nine, which is a big commercial reemergence. You would expect him to capitalize on that, maybe have a follow-up album, maybe have a tour. But he goes off and forms a supergroup with Bob Dylan and Roy Orbison, as you do.
And, you know, what we're going to tease out across two episodes on the Traveling Wilburys is exactly what you said. George is the most successful out of the five going in. His stock is certainly, from a solo George point of view, at an all-time high. And 88 is the year of the Beatles on CD and all sorts of reissues and things. You know, everything's 87, 88 is Beatles on CD. And he's, you know, he seems to be the only one out of the five who doesn't really come out of it making hay while the sun shines. You know, the others do quite well on the far side of the Wilburys.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, he's coming in. He's coming off the back of an American number one single.
Yep.
You know, he is absolutely top of his game. Again, he's with Warners at this stage, which is a record label he's very comfortable with. He's coming out of a sort of hiatus. He's outselling Paul. Ringo's on the out. You know, so yes, George, I suppose, never does what you expect him to do.
This is true. And he, as you say, has this double whammy of being at a really successful high point in his career and being a Beatle. And so you get to do what you want, and he decides to do this. So let's try and pick it apart, because there is this sort of legend of the Wilburys that, you know, George himself was quite happy to propagate. But it kind of starts as a name, doesn't it?
Yes, and we, you know, we'll come on to this, but I think a lot of the sort of the legend is just that. I think there's a lot of artifice that goes beyond the made-up names. But supposedly the name comes from the Cloud Nine sessions, where he and Jeff come up with this term. Something's not quite right. They say we'll bury this in the mix. So that becomes, you know, a Wilbury becomes the name for a glitch or a technical problem, and it kind of comes from that George suggested at one point Trembling Wilbury as a joke name, and then it became Traveling Wilburys. Supposedly after a royal intervention.
Yeah, now apparently heir to the throne, Prince Charles, is actually responsible for naming the traveling Wilburys. But again, this seems to be part of George's love of obfuscation, of kind of muddying the waters a little bit and a good joke. It could be true. It's probably not true.
Oh, it's bound to be true. The way George tells it, it's absolutely got to be true.
I mean, so knowing Prince Charles like I do, it does sound like a Prince Charles thing.
Yeah. Does Charles sound like him? So this is after a Prince's Trust concert in 1987, and George said that, you know, they're meeting Prince Charles after that, and he stops beside George and Jeff and said, "You chaps work very well together. Why don't you form a group called the Traveling Wilburys?" And George said, "Well, it seemed a bit strange at the time. We had no such plans. But later we thought, well, if he likes it, maybe we should use that name." So it's entirely the result of Prince Charles coming up with the name.
Yes, and that's obviously a lie. It's kind of got that Monty Python preposterousness that George likes. Yeah. And so, yeah, this notion of, you know, we'll bury them in the mix, the Wilburys. There's also, you know, some other early mentions. maybe it wasn't even a turn of phrase. It was also a guitar pick that George is knocking around this notion of the Traveling Wilburys as an entity before they even exist.
Yes. I mean, George, if we know anything about George, is his kind of love of Monty Python and his particularly his love of a pun, never letting a good joke or a bad joke die. So he seems to have followed on from this sort of we bury it in the mix notion to producing little guitar picks. So he's got the merchandise before he's got the band. And there's an engineer called Bill Bottrell, who refers to in early late 87, they're working on a mix, and George hands him one of these guitar picks and said, you know, I guess we're going to have a group or something. So he's got this name from late 87, and he's working on the idea.
Yeah, and you know, the whole thread running through all of this is that the Traveling Wilburys is the will of George. You know, he is willing it into existence, and you know, at best it's a great success. At worst, it's almost it feels like a parent, like, you know, we're having a good time, aren't we? There's a bit of that runs through the Traveling Wilburys a little bit. So he has this name, he has these guitar picks, and he mentions the notion of the Traveling Wilburys publicly for the first time in February 1988 on a syndicated radio interview on the American show Rockline. And I know that you love George's Rockline interview. You think this is the best George interview, that everyone should stop what they're doing now. Well, maybe wait till the end of the episode and then go and listen to the Rockline interview.
Absolutely. This is a chap called Bob Coburn, and it was a phone-in setup. So it's a syndicated show, so you could phone in from anywhere in the US. And anybody who got on air got a signed George Harrison LP, and you got to ask George a question. And this is the most revealing interview. So he starts off, supposedly he Jeff Lynne is there as well. This is a promotion for Cloud Nine. And supposedly George and Jeff had been slightly refreshed. You know, they'd been at the minibar beforehand. And the first people that call in just get the sarky, surly, really quite rude George. I mean, you would just be so upset if you'd called at the beginning and he terrible to these people. But as the interview goes on, he becomes quite revealing and quite morose. But at one point, Coburn says, you know, and you know, what are you going to do now? How are you going to follow up Cloud Nine? And he says, what I'd really like to do next is to do an album with me and some of my mates. It's this new group I've got in mind. It's called the Traveling Wilburys. Coburn does not pick up on this at all. You know, George is saying specifically, I'd like to do an album with them, and then later on we can do our albums again. And Coburn just completely moves past it.
I don't blame him though for moving past it, because, you know, in a parallel universe, it's just a forgotten notion. It's just a joke thing. You know, he runs in this kind of slipstream of answering questions, George, you know, what's real, what's not, you know, what's true, what's a bit of a joke. So, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you know, here we are all these years later going, that's panning for gold. That's what he mentioned.
That's what he mentioned. I mean, the other thing that's very interesting about the Rockline interview is how often George talks about Bob Dylan and how much sort of support he gives to Dylan. You know, he kind of just referring back to everything that Dylan has done and you know, what a great lyricist Dylan is and what a great songwriter. George has this habit in the way that other people quote poetry or verses from the Bible. George quotes Dylan lyrics.
He does,
He spends quite a lot of time in this interview referring to Bob Dylan, who was not having a good 1980s. Let's be honest about that, you know?
No, and we don't want to incur the wrath of the Dylanologists on us, who will tell us, but actually we haven't heard the alternate infidels or whatever we were supposed to be listening to today. But, you know, if you look purely on stats, the albums that Bob had out at the time, Empire Burlesque came out in June 1985 and it didn't make the US top 30. Knocked Out Loaded came out in July 86. That didn't make the US top 50. You think that's Rex's worst album, don't you? Knocked Out Loaded.
I remember rushing to the shops to buy that and take it home and just pay. It's just anything with a children's choir is never a good it's never a good bet. There's one great track, Brownsville Girl,
but yeah, Brownsville Girl's good. I thought you were gonna say there's one great album with a children's choir, and I'm trying to I didn't know you liked The Wall. But there's something we've discussed about in our lives before, which is the curse of 1986. 1986 is a very odd year for the 60s vanguard of musicians. That there's a lot of them that are at a low ebb commercially, maybe creatively, depending on which side of the press to play fence that you're on. But there's certainly something happening in 86. The only person who kind of emerges is Paul Simon with Graceland in 86. But Dylan's having a hard time. Paul's not really the man locked in that he normally expects to be. The Stones release. Dirty Work. It's all a bit wonky.
I think there aren't many of that vanguard, that era, have a good mid-80s. Steve Winwood and Paul Simon are probably the only two I can think of off the top
of my
head.
I think what we'll kind of go to see is the Traveling Wilburys is almost a way, it's almost like a primer to try and show these folks how to redefine themselves in the late 80s and have a, try and play to the old house and also have a little bit of a contemporary sheen as well. So that's kind of what we're going to see. And playing amateur psychologist for a moment, George is saying, I want to form a group. And, listeners to the podcast might remember that he was already in a group. And is this, is he trying to rerun, something that's going on in his psyche about the Fabs to show how a successful group should be, or that he never got to lead the Beatles in a way that he wanted to, or is any of that important really? Are the Traveling Wilburys the anti-Beatles in a way,
Okay, we'll develop that theory. I think one of the characteristics of George's sort of post fame. So even when he was in the Beatles, he was saying, I didn't really want the fame. I really didn't want, all the adulation. He quite likes the money, likes that side of it. But he's always saying, I just wanted to be a guitar player. I just wanted to be in a band and to make music. And he's constantly sort of referencing that. In the early 70s, he wants to be in a band with John Lennon. He sort of floats that idea and he gets knocked back by Lennon, who thinks it's quite embarrassing to have George making that kind of overture. He is a sort of guitar player for hire. He works on a lot of other people's material, albums and songs, and he starts his own record label. He really tries to replicate what Apple tried to do in terms of Dark Horse. He's collaborative in nature. And I think this is the sort of ultimate expression of that.
I think you're right. He is a good person to have in a collaboration. When we look at the people who are in the Traveling Wilburys, and of course the people in the Traveling Wilburys are, Roy Orbison, Bob Dylan, Jeff Lynne, Tom Petty. These are very forceful kind of personalities. And although you could argue Jeff Lynne and Tom Petty technically weren't solo artists, they were definitely people who had marked their own territory within the bands that they were in as de facto leaders, essentially in a, it's my way or the highway type leaders of bands. Yeah. So you kind of wonder, is George a little bit naive sometimes with this notion of, well, let's all just hang around and play guitars and collaborate. That's how bands work. Because, life isn't quite as straightforward as that sometimes.
Well, there's this idea that he's trying to get back to the way the Beatles were before 1962, that they were kind of just hanging around in Paul's house.
But were they ever like that? Because they were always trying to get successful, move ahead, get to the next thing, do whatever worked. There wasn't... I think what he was trying to get away from was, the stuff that really wound him up, which was the suits and the business people and the interventions.
The other thing to bear in mind around this time is the relationship with the other Beatles and the relationship with the MI and the lawsuits that are going on. So he's, we're coming up to the release of the Beatles catalog on CD, but there are still all of these lawsuits going on in the background. John isn't there. Yoko is reasonably active at this point in the late 80s. So we've got the
there's also Lennon the Rock and Roll Estate. Hall of Fame stuff as well.
There's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Yep. So there's still the there's still aggravation around the Beatles. So he's maybe stepping away from that as well. But it is an expression, I think, of his star power at the time. That he's suddenly from nowhere, from absolutely nowhere, he's back at the top of the US charts. No one would have put money on that.
Yeah. Well, let's go into a bit of background in terms of, you know, the five people that made up the Traveling Wilburys, about how their paths had crossed in the preceding years and how it got to that point in 1988. The obvious first combo is, George Harrison and Bob Dylan. And we have talked about this before, that they originally met up in Woodstock in the late 60s, and the May 1970 session is currently available on CD after all these years.
Yep.
And, there's the Bob influence on All Things Must Pass, the co-write of I'd Have You Anytime. They're already, paired off many years earlier.
They are. And I mean, I think I do get the sense that particularly for John and perhaps also for Paul, George's relationship with Dylan was a sort of source of envy. Lennon in particular could never, I think, transcend the fact that he was John Lennon, to get to the point where he could have a relationship where he could step outside that Lennon persona and allow Dylan to step outside his persona. But George seems to have been able to navigate that. And one of my favorite phrases is in the Rob Sheffield book, Dreaming the Beatles, where he says that in the Beatles divorce, George got custody of Bob Dylan.
Yeah. And
I think that's true. He cultivated that relationship. And I remember there was an interview where somebody said to George, were you not slightly in awe of working with Bob Dylan? And George said, well, maybe he was slightly in awe of working with me, which is obviously tongue in cheek. But he didn't have that same ego issue with Dylan that, he clearly admires him. We talked about him quoting the lyrics, he admired him, he respected him. But that didn't get in the way of the friendship or a productive relationship.
Yeah. And I think, it always seemed to me that Bob and George, there never seemed to be any kind of angle with their friendship. They had a totally reasonable back and forth. And so by the time that friendship rolls into the 80s and, George is, as you say, quoting Dylan all the time, likes to play Dylan in his spare time. And, the most obvious place for George to record a Bob Dylan song in 1987 was where?
That was the soundtrack of Porky's Revenge. It's a very George type movie.
Yes. Now for some of the younger viewers, Porky's was a series of films in the 80s that people would dare each other to get out of video clubs.
it's so bizarre that George Harrison tries. So he records a song called I Don't Want to Do It, which he'd done an earlier version of during the All Things Must Pass sessions. And Dave Edmonds was the producer for that. And then Dave Edmonds introduces George to Jeff. So
what a momentous that's where I'll take over.
Well, I always think Dave Edmonds must be quite annoyed that he wasn't sort of either asked to produce Cloud Nine or asked to be in the Wilburys, but he was instrumental in getting them together. So
Dave Edmonds, I think, is a fascinating figure. He's recently retired from music a few years ago, and as you say, he produced this song at the end of November 84, I Don't Want to Do It, for the Porky soundtrack. And he had a very successful run, Dave Edmonds. He had hits, obviously, like I Hear You Knocking, and he did Elvis Costello's Girls Talk, and he was in the band Rock Pile with Nick Lowe, and he was one of these kind of producer, writer, players, performers. But you could also argue that he never kind of crossed over into the big leagues the way Jeff made his hit for the big leagues in the 80s. And what's happening in Jeff Lynne land in the early 80s is that, Jeff is tired of the ELO life. Can you imagine being tired of ELO? If you're tired of ELO, you must be tired of life.
And I was biting my lip. I was not going to make a comment. But
in 1983, the year of Jeff's and ELO's Beatles Forever and Secret Messages album, Jeff is trying to find a sideline, I know, in record production. And one of the people Jeff produces with is Dave Edmunds. So there's Dave Edmunds puts out an album in 83 called Information. And the lead single off that, which is his last kind of big US hit, is Slipping Away, is written and produced by Jeff. And Jeff also produces some tracks on the follow-up album Riff Raff in 84. And he wrote about three songs on that as well. So Jeff is diversifying into production. He's kind of finding his feet for that successful run he's about to tap into in the late 80s. And he's learning producer tricks, I guess. He's learning how to disappear behind the console in a way he couldn't with ELO, and he's learning how to manage artists, you could argue. But it is Dave Edmunds who makes the connection between George and Jeff. And it's at some point in these sessions that Dave Edmunds has a dinner with Jeff. And at the end of it, Jeff recounts, Dave Edmunds says to him, "Oh, by the way, George Harrison told me he wants to get in touch with you." And Jeff, as a Beatles head, is happy, I would say.
It's a nice end to the dinner.
It's nice. Yeah, so by the way, so on the extras...
I nearly forgot to tell you. I nearly forgot.
On the extras of the Living in the Material World documentary, Jeff talks about meeting George for the first time. Obviously, he was cut out of the main film because he was too interesting. But he talks about Dave Edmunds setting up this date, and Jeff goes up to Friar Park and realizes straight away that him and George can get on. Famously, because George sticks him in a boat and sails him around the grottos of Friar Park, and you hang on with your bum, is what Jeff tells us.
To be a millionaire rock star.
So they have a very, in what they call in the movies foreshadowing. The first appearance of George and Jeff is kind of ominous, isn't it?
Is it? Is this the Heartbeat 86?
This is Heartbeat 86 we're talking about. You don't watch your video of Heartbeat 86 every weekend.
Do you have it on VHS somewhere?
It's on. So Heartbeat 86 was a gig in Birmingham in 1986 for Children's Hospital Services in the Midlands in the UK, and it was designed in the wake of we were in the post Live Aid era, that it would be a charity gig celebrating all the great and the good of 20 years of Birmingham music, and Bev Bevan, the drummer from ELO, was the person kind of primarily driving some of this. So you had Roy Wood turning up. You had members of Slade. You had Robert Plant rocked up to this gig,
and Denny Lane
was there.
There
was supposed to be a reunion of The Move, but it didn't happen. But the headliners were ELO, doing their first UK gig in about 5 years, and also pretty much their last UK gig. And because they're about to fall apart spectacularly. Yeah. And as I said, in a point of foreshadowing, right at the end of the gig, when ELO are doing their final track, Jeff brings on George Harrison, as if to say, meet my new wife.
This is my new best friend. Yeah. Bye, Bev.
Yes. Yeah. See you later. And so, this Heartbeat show was recorded and edited for TV. It's on YouTube. You can go check it out and have a look at it. People are having a pretty good day out, and they're all the more happy that George appears. George is appearing at lots of these kind of Prince's Trust charity gigs. He's not a total shrinking violet at this time.
It's sort of this, I suppose, really marks the start of his return to the limelight. This gig and then the Prince's Trust gig comes later in middle of 1987. So this is him emerging back into the spotlight.
Yeah. So after, ELO finally go into the ground, Jeff goes off and works with George. The first track that they start working on is in January 87 and turns out to be When We Was Fab. So I can't imagine how happy Jeff Lynne is writing and recording When We Was Fab with George Harrison. Jeff says, "Hey," or George says to Jeff, "Do you know any Beatle tricks, Jeff?" Jeff goes, "I sure do." So those guys are set up, and the Jeff and George production dynamic is very important for what subsequently becomes the Traveling Wilburys. The other interesting relationship that's happening at the same time in the mid 80s is that between Bob Dylan and Tom Petty. Yes. And I always found this diversion. And when we say Tom Petty, we really mean Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
And the Heartbreakers, yeah.
And yeah, this is a band like the Heartbreakers, who, you know, were having a good commercial run, for them to kind of take a left turn and decide, do you know what we're going to do? We're going to be Bob Dylan's backup band for a significant period of time. It's wild, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's Bob Dylan.
It is Bob Dylan.
It is Bob Dylan, you know. So they first get together, I think, in 1985 at Farm Aid. So that seems to me to be a sort of a temporary or as just a, it's fortuitous, and they get together. It's one gig, but they clearly work well together. And Petty and the Heartbreakers are that sort of steeped in American rock and roll. They can play anything. So they embark on a tour with Dylan, which has Tom Petty as the opening act, or sometimes actually they tour with Roger McGuinn as the opening act, and then you get Tom Petty, and then you get Bob Dylan comes on with Petty and the Heartbreakers. Stevie Nicks turns up at one point, starts hanging out on the tour and coming on stage with the band as well. Dylan is sort of reinventing himself, or really struggling at this point to reconnect, I think, with his muse.
Yeah.
One of the interesting features of the Tom Petty tour is how often Dylan will go back to old 1950s rock and roll songs, obscure rock and roll songs that, you know, Mike Campbell has said you didn't know what he was going to ask you to play from one gig to the next. There's great songs, So Long, Good Luck and Goodbye, which he used to use as the opening song. Petty and the Heartbreakers are a very good fit. They tour Europe in late 1987. They do a big gig in October 87 at Wembley, and George makes a guest appearance for the encore at that show. So there you have three of them on stage together, three people who would become the Wilburys.
Yes. And I think Dylan and Petty also tour in Australia as well. They record a TV special down there, which is also available on YouTube, a live concert.
They do.
You can't help but feel that there's a Dylan Petty bootleg box set somewhere in the pipeline at Columbia Records.
There are a lot of very well recorded bootleg sets, live sets. But this is the period in which Bob is wearing his black leather waistcoat and his fingerless leather gloves, and
what was that movie, Streets or
Hearts of Fire. You know, he's really, as you were saying earlier, that kind of mid 80s period, all of these sort of 60s rock royalty are just slightly lost. They don't know what to do. They're all getting to a certain age as well, you know, and there's no roadmap for what do you do when you hit 40.
Well, I was a teenager in the late 80s, and obviously I was very into 60s music, and the whole culture at that time was kind of, these guys are so old, they're in their 40s, this is a joke. Yeah. Typified by, there's a 1989 cover story on the Rolling Stones in Q, which says, lock up your granddaughters, it's the Rolling Stones, average age 44. So, it's we now can see that these people were kind of at a vanguard, that they were, we don't notice other bands getting old. We don't notice U2 in their 60s these days, because these guys kind of knocked that down,
Yes, usually by up to this point, by the time you got to be 40 or 45, you were in Vegas, or you were doing, the cabaret circuit. You weren't making new music. And I think that's, everybody got slightly lost until they found their way out into the 90s.
So for Petty and the Heartbreakers, they were a band who, although they, emerged circa 77 with their debut album, they always doffed their cap to the 60s. And I think they relished the opportunity to work on their chops as Bob Dylan's backing band, as mercurial an enterprise as that can turn out to be. But again, it meant that, game recognizes game, and Dylan, I think, respected their abilities and saw what they could do, and obviously forged a friendship with Tom Petty. Because I think, when the Wilburys comes out, sometimes Tom seems like, well, he's a bit young. He seems of a different generation. But Dylan and Petty are obviously quite close. And indeed, when the, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers reemerge in 87, it's with a single co-written with Bob Dylan.
Yes, they do a single. It's really a Bob Dylan single, Band of the Hand, comes out. And then Jam and Me is a Campbell You know, it's not a great song. I mean, there's neither of those songs are particularly good. And it's interesting that Dylan at this point, you know, there aren't more writing collaborations with Petty. Yeah. You know, the Jam and Me song seems to be a riff that Campbell and Petty had that Dylan threw a few lyrics at. Really, Dylan is not firing on all cylinders at this point.
I mean, I'm kind of fond of Jam and Me, but it does have references to Saturday Night Live and Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo in it, which is obviously
just a song written for you.
It is. And it has this odd kind of trying to be contemporary Cars type video attached to it. But, at that point, I you could argue that Tom and the Heartbreakers, you know, they were 10 years into their career, and you're kind of at a crossroads at that point where, you know, are you going to choose diminishing returns, or are you going to have some kind of grand leap forward and go the distance? And, you know, with the album that came out in 87 from them, Let Me Up, I've Had Enough, it wasn't really any sign of a grand leap forward. It was possible that it could have been diminishing returns for Tom Petty, that, you know, the big albums of Damn the Torpedoes and that were behind them. So, what we'll see is that, you know, Full Moon Fever is on the horizon on the far side of the Wilburys, but we'll come to that in due course. So, Petty's kind of at this point in his career about figuring out what to do, which kind of leads us into the fact that Jeff Lynne goes into the Tom Petty orbit at this time as well, because, as we said, eventually Full Moon Fever is what's going to happen. And the seeds of Full Moon Fever predate the Wilburys.
Yes. So this is Tom Petty's, I suppose, this must be his first solo album.
Yeah.
At least in name. So, you know, most of the Heartbreakers turn up at some point, but he's got Jeff Lynne on board as the producer. And you've got to sort of wonder, is Tom Petty thinking, a solo career is maybe what's going to get me through the 80s? One of the other things that we shouldn't underestimate is the introduction of digital production style. Mm-hmm. So, this is something that where Paul comes slightly adrift on Press to Play, although it's an album that I do admire. Mm-hmm. I know you don't hold it in the same regard. But these people were very familiar with the studio. They were quite capable of producing their own material. And then suddenly everything changes with the introduction of, it wasn't punk that killed off the dinosaurs. It was the Fairlight, this digital, digital production. And you think, well, this is part of negotiating the way forward, is to get an external producer to come in. And although Jeff Lynne is not kind of a hotshot young producer, he's sufficiently au fait with sort of the studio technique, but also of an age where he has a certain empathy with the likes of Tom Petty. So he can help navigate through that that production issue as well.
What you kind of learn about Jeff is he's quite happy doing the bits of the job that many musicians don't like, which is sitting behind the desk for about 6 hours trying to get something to work. And even, I'm thinking of a story later on when, Paul is working on Flaming Pie with Jeff, and Paul recounts how Jeff is just a stickler for detail, just to try and nail stuff down, whereas other people would walk away, if you're not paying close attention to Tom Petty's career, you might notice that Full Moon Fever is a solo album and not a Heartbreakers album, but that is important because it comes together differently and the Heartbreakers drift in and out of it, but it is essentially a solo album where he gets to do what he wants. The other person who goes into Jeff Lynne's orbit as Jeff moves into his producer for hire mode is Roy Orbison. And, Roy Orbison is at another inflection point in his career where he's trying to figure out the next great leap forward. And Roy Orbison hadn't put out a record since an album called Laminar Flow in 1979. What a record that is.
What a record sleeve that is.
If you don't know the sleeve of George Orbison, Roy Orbison's Laminar Flow, dig it out. It's quite spectacular. The album itself is very much of 1979. It's recorded in Muscle Shoals. It has the disco song up front trying to get Roy a disco hit. And it kind of has a thick session heavy studio sound. It doesn't really work. And, Roy kind of floats away for a few years. I mean, he's busy and he's working and he's regarded, but he's not at the vanguard of anything.
No, I mean, during that period of the early 80s, you know, there's a very good documentary about that period, and you know, he's appearing on these terrible English you know, variety shows with awful backup bands and in wide lapelled jackets and TikTok-y drums and just terrible. It's a very dispiriting thing. And this is what I was saying. The roadmap up to this point is you have your hits, you have your career, you hit 40, and then you're relegated to the cabaret circuit. And that's very much where he was sort of marooned at that point.
And, you know, in the second half of 87, the sessions begin for Mystery Girl, which is due to be Roy Orbison's return to form comeback album. And, you know, when George's Cloud Nine drops, you know, Jeff Lynne is obviously seen as a successful producer, and he gets drafted in as one of the producers and co-writers for Mystery Girl. And with Tom Petty, Orbison and Lynne all together, they write the hit You've Got It, which, you know, will come out post Traveling Wilburys. But the other thing that happens to solidify Roy Orbison at this point in time is the concert of Black and White Night, which to my mind at the time was really influential in how highly regarded he was. And A Black and White Night was a live concert recorded at the Coconut Grove at the Ambassador Hotel in Hollywood, California on the 30th of September, 1987. And I'm guessing a lot of people listening to us here today will have seen it. Roy is backed up by a star-studded band with Bruce Springsteen and Elvis Costello. And who else is there? I think it's Katie Lang.
Jackson Brown, Katie Lang, Jennifer Warnes.
Yeah. But no Wilburys. No Wilburys are in the crowd at A Black and White Night, which is interesting.
No Jeff yet.
Jeff hadn't arrived in Roy's garden yet. And, you know, that was recorded at the end of September 87. It was broadcast in January 88. Interestingly enough, I read the day after it was recorded, there was an earthquake and parts of the hotel collapsed in on the master tapes. So it was almost lost to the ages, but the tapes were recovered and fixed. And so we still got to get A Black and White Night. But as we get to the end of 87, you know, the big hit is Cloud Nine, and it's at number one in the US at the start of 88, with Got My Mind Set on You is the big smash hit single off that. And I don't think anyone expected at the start of 87 that George Harrison would be a number one Billboard US star at the start of 88.
No, the last number one by a Beatle. Isn't that right? Did Spies Like Us get to number one?
No. Let me just check my Rolodex here. Spies Like Us did not get to number one. But it kind of lights the torch paper for the whole Wilburys project, because as the singles come out for Cloud Nine, you know, George, as is the want at the time, is pressed to get some kind of bonus tracks or B-sides to go with the single. And the single that's planned to come out is It Love from Cloud Nine. And George, you know, is trying to figure out how he's going to get his B-side ready. And we'll tell you how he got that B-side ready after this break.
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. So in April 1988, George is in Los Angeles, and he's there because what we kind of forget is that he's also a big movie producer at this time. And there's a movie being made there in production called Checking Out, which I'm sure we've all seen. Have we seen? No.
No.
It's one of the movies from the latter days of handmade films. I think if you check Wikipedia, it grossed something like $1,500. It's probably something that pushed the company into the tailspin that it eventually went into following on from Shanghai Surprise. But he's in LA, and This Is Love is due to be the third single from Cloud Nine. I think I called it Is It Love a few minutes ago.
I was getting my George mixed up. I wasn't going to correct you.
So This Is Love is due to be the third single from Cloud Nine. And, you know, CD singles are coming into vogue and B-sides and exclusive tracks and all the rest. So there's an official story about what happens. And it's kind of true, but there's a little, there's maybe a few details left out, but it's the official story is, oh, it's just this magically spontaneous thing.
Yes. And I mean, I think the sequence of it, to my reading, the sequence of events is correct, but I think it's the intent to push this forward is what is never discussed. It is a spot portrayed as a spontaneous, you know, we were sitting having a meal, we said we were going to do this, then we thought, oh, I've got to go there, then we've got to go there, and the next thing we're recording a Traveling Wilburys song. And you think there's a lot more to it than that. So I think the timing and the sequence of events is definitely correct.
Well, what we're trying to lay down is that there is this notion that George wants to do a Traveling Wilburys group. He just hasn't decided. And this sequence of events, George, consciously or unconsciously, it's a bit of a land grab for him to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is the sequence of events?
So supposedly, George and Jeff, they go out for a meal with Roy Orbison. Jeff is working with Roy at this point. And George mentions that, you know, he has to come up with what he calls a C-side, a third track for a 12-inch sort of CD single. And he's going to record this tomorrow. And he asks Jeff, would he come and help him with this? Now, it's inconceivable that was not lined up. You don't just say to Jeff Lynne, who is working on another project with Roy Orbison, sure, just, you know, abandon that and come and work with me tomorrow.
Yeah.
But Jeff supposedly agrees to this. Roy says, you know, do you mind if I come along? If you're doing something, can I come and hang out? And yeah, absolutely. So the scene is set. And then George says he needed to pick up a guitar because George only has one guitar.
He just has one guitar. And whose house does it happen to be in?
It's in Tom Petty's house.
What are the chances?
You know, so Tom Petty says when he came by to get it, I wasn't doing anything. So I said, hey, I'll come along. And at that point, Jeff had a brainstorm and said, why don't we go to Bob's house and record there? So it's all very pat. What George says is, you know, he then rings Bob, and in interviews he said, you know, you can ring Bob and he won't answer the phone for 2 years. But this time he just picked up on the first ring and we said, can we all come over and record something in your garage? And he went, yeah, not a problem. So it's like it's a bit like a Cliff Richard movie, you know. I said, let's do the show right here.
Well, you know, one of the threads we often pull here is on this podcast is the serendipity of events in the Beatle universe. So maybe we're being cynical old heads to say this seems a bit unreal that it goes from, you know, whatever, 9 p.m. one evening in a restaurant and the following evening they've recorded the song that turns out to be Handle With Care. And but, you know, assuming that it all comes together that quickly, like in a let's do the show right here type of vibe, you know, they have, as you say, Tom Petty flags that George has this little garage studio / rehearsal space.
Bob has a little Bob.
Oh, who did I say? George, pardon me. George. Oh, dear. Bob has this recording studio, rehearsal space in Malibu, and they should all go down there and record. There's a little bit of the story being left out because Jeff knows about this studio.
Jeff knows about this studio, and we come back to the importance of Jeff having been at this studio before.
The importance of Jeff is a statement I really
importance of Jeff, but. Supposedly, this is something that Jeff Lynne has mentioned. I've never heard anybody else mention this, but Jeff refers to the fact that he and Bill Bottrell had been to the studio a few months earlier. And what he says is, we did a little song with Bob just on our own, I'm in the Mood for Love. Now, I have consulted the finest Dylan experts that I know on another podcast. Is it Rolling Pod? You should all be listening to that podcast. And this is not a song that is known about.
But it is the standard, I'm in the Mood for Love, simply because you're near me.
We assume that this is the case. There is a song of a similar name that turned up on the Basement Tapes, which is an old blues song, but we assume that this is the standard. And this obviously is years before Dylan embarks on his Sinatra covers period. And you've got to wonder, what was he doing with Jeff Lynne in that shed? You know, what were they working on? What was the purpose of that? Was Dylan maybe in the same boat as Roy Orbison and Tom Petty, thinking, oh, look what Jeff Lynne did for George Harrison? You know, my career is twisting in the wind a bit. Do I need some of this?
Did he realize, if trusting George, that Jeff would be if George can work with him, I could work with him type thing.
Yeah.
It is possible that it is the standard, because there is YouTube clips of Bob doing I'm in the Mood for Love in 1989, which apparently he plays live, the first time. So assuming it's rattling around his head, that might be it. So there is this unreleased, unknown Jeff and Bob collaboration that predates that, and that was apparently laid down in this this studio. So they eventually all end up going down there. And again, it comes back to this thing of, you know, the will of George trying to push it into existence, because, you know, George, it's not that he's written Handle With Care, but he hasn't not written a song that turns out to be quite similar to Handle With Care when he walks in the door.
Yes, he seems to arrive with a song at least half written. Over the years, Jeff and Tom Petty have both acknowledged, you know, that this is really a George song. And it was sort of roughed out, fleshed out in the studio, but this was a George Harrison song. So he comes, and again, you think it's inconceivable that they would just turn up with all of that talent and not have something specific. You know, George Harrison doesn't, if there's one thing we know about George Harrison, is he is very meticulous when he gets into a studio. He's not an improviser. He's not someone that just sort of pulls solos from thin air. He works through. So he comes with something to work on. They arrive at the studio, and the studio is not in good shape. The engineer says, Dylan's studio was just a pile of equipment that Dave Stewart had sold them. It hadn't ever really been used. It was semi-connected. There was a lot of work involved on the part of the engineer to get this to work. Now, again, bear in mind, we've already said that Jeff and this engineer have been in this studio before.
Mm. Yeah, so they should have known.
So they should have known. So why would you suggest going to work in a studio that was going to take a while to set up and wasn't really the best environment, unless you were trying to get Bob on board? And my theory, for what it's worth, is that perhaps the only person that didn't know they were in a band that day was Bob Dylan. And the George was sort of saying, right, you know what, we can do this, and we can kind of bounce Bob Dylan into being in our band. I think everybody else was on board and knew what was happening, but perhaps Bob was blindsided by this slightly.
Well, in a 1990 interview, George kind of confirms, by saying, I started the tune the next morning, I got a few chords, Tom and Jeff picked me up, we went over to Bob's, we sat in his lawn and wrote the song, the music to it, and we went in and put it down, just a machine and some acoustics. I thought, we might as well get them all playing, and we went out there and wrote the words. And, Dylan is kind of wondering, what are you doing, George? And George says, we're just going to write it. George, like as if Bob Dylan doesn't know spontaneity. Yeah. And, Dylan says, how could you do such a thing? And George looks at a two-reel tape box from Ampex that says, Handle With Care.
Handle With Care.
That's the legend. And, Jeff Lynne says, it's, five microphones, strumming guitars in a semicircle, all double tracked. You get a shimmery, thick sound, a thick skiffle. That wall of acoustics is the Jeff Lynne baton into the charts for the next few years.
Patented sound, yeah.
So they're apparently all throwing around lines to get this song finished, but it does. Again, you kind of wonder what each of the participants was thinking at this point, because they're supposed to be there for, this B-side project and maybe just having a day out and having a lark. And, maybe they're not thinking about, whose name is going to be on the songwriting or the publishing or any of that kind of stuff. And if it's George, that's fine. We've all had a nice day out kind of thing.
Yeah.
But they are all throwing lines out. So Tom Petty says he throws out, Oh, the Sweet Smell of Success. Which is possibly one of the funniest lines in it when you think about it, because they're literally describing all the horrors of being famous in the song.
It's this notion that, after they got the rhythm track, Bob fires up the barbecue. So you've got Bob Dylan barbecuing for Roy Orbison, Tom Petty, Jeff Lynne, and George Harrison, and George sitting with a pen and paper saying, okay, give me some words. And everybody's just throwing out lines. So, you know, I think everybody knew what they were going to do. I think the other yes. four, this is what's going to happen. But as soon as you start recording and people get solo vocal lines,
yes,
it's clear that this is not and cannot be a George Harrison track.
Yeah, well, one of the things I love about the notion of this day is we've kind of shown that there's threads between George and Jeff and Bob and Tom and all that, but there hasn't been a Bob and Roy kind of intersection yet. And that seems to happen on this day. And, you know, again, amateur psychologist time, you look at that dynamic of the Wilburys, the dynamic between Bob and Roy is fantastic. And I think Jeff said it brilliantly because he said, you know, we've the world's greatest singer and the world's greatest lyricist in the one band for the first time. And I think he's totally right there. That there's such a mutual respect between Bob and Roy that I think out of all the people in the band, Bob is the most, you know, the one that he's most in awe of is that he's singing with Roy Orbison, that he's in a band with Roy Orbison. And Roy Orbison, I think, simultaneously doesn't believe his luck that he gets to hang out with Bob Dylan.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's Dylan's respect for Roy Orbison that is the key to making that first day work, because Dylan is notoriously inhabits the character of Bob Dylan. So he just projects that constantly, and everybody is in awe of Bob Dylan. You know, the Bruce Springsteen, you know, says, you know, Dylan walks into the room, no matter who else is in the room, everybody turns to look at Dylan. So I think the fact that Dylan is not, in one sense, kind of top dog here. You know, he's not the most famous person in the room. He's not the most influential person in the room. He is slightly in awe, and he's very respectful of Roy Orbison. Shifts that dynamic, and you think it must be a long time since Dylan was in that position.
But he must be happy to be in that position, because it's a new sensation in a way, or it's a
takes the pressure off him. And I mean, Dylan must be very conscious as well in that sort of company that his voice is the kind of least impressive thing there. You know, his voice is, you know, you've seen him at that We Are the World recording session. And you think he's singing with Stevie Wonder. He's singing with, so suddenly to be in a room with Roy Orbison must be a very different experience.
I think sometimes, you know, Dylan gets short shrift because people think, you know, he might be not engaged or, you know, dialing it in sometimes, particularly at this point in the 80s, but that's not really true. And as the Wilburys evolves, Dylan's very much on board and he's as part of it as anybody else. But we'll come back to that when we talk about the main album sessions. You know, Tom Petty does seem to, you know, in subsequent interviews, reinforce that, you know, it does seem to happen spontaneously, or as spontaneous as these things can be. I can't imagine how it happened, he said, because it did. So he does describe a certain magic to it. And Roy Orbison's I'm So Tired of Being Lonely, I think, is Roy's contribution, just to, because they're all wondering, how do we get, we have to have Roy sing a line. He can't not sing a line in this song.
That's it. They say, you know, there's no point having this song. And it's a very kind of standard skiffle sound until Roy comes in with that. Mm. And they wrote that specifically to make best use of his voice. And so I think, I mean, I do think in one sense it's spontaneous that they're sort of writing and they're throwing out these lines. But I do think that George, as you said earlier, is just willing this into existence. And that the person who is last to come on board is Bob Dylan. And I think that George's motivation for doing this is at least in part as a kind of reaching out to Bob Dylan, you know, to say, look, this is, you know, you're Bob Dylan. You know, you can sort of to remind him of who he is and what he's capable of. And at a time when Dylan was really his commercial stock. And I think his own sort of belief in his abilities was at a low point.
So Tom Petty describes how they did nearly all of it that night, the vocals, Jeff Lynne played the drums. But the next day, actually, they're in a proper studio, and it seems to be mainly George and Jeff who are in studio the next day with a few other folks trying to actually put a polish on it.
Yeah. So again, they've recorded this at Dylan's house. And, you know, the legend is we recorded the song at Dylan's house, but they didn't really. That this is a sort of rough run through the song at Dylan's house. They've got Bob's vocals, they got there. But then what happens is the next day they go into a professional studio and George promptly re-records his vocal.
Yeah.
And they start applying the patented Jeff Lynne magic.
The Jeff Lynne magic. The non-stop tinkering of Jeff Lynne.
So they have to, they then, but this is, you know, I will give a credit to Jeff Lynne for this point. You know, this is what he excels at. He can take this kind of rough material and he can polish it up. Whether he kind of sometimes doesn't know when to stop polishing it, that is maybe my issue. Is sometimes it's a little, he loses the spontaneity, but you know, so they need to record a guitar solo. So, you know, you've got George Harrison there. So what do? You call Mike Campbell of the Heartbreakers to come and play the guitar.
So Tom Petty is there and Mike Campbell goes down and he tries to make a few passes at a guitar solo without losing his nerve. But eventually he says to George, you know, why don't you just do your slide guitar? Yeah. Because, you know, it's that.
It's George Harrison. So yeah, he records the fact that he's playing these solos. He sounds a bit something that Clapton would do, and he said he sets his guitar down and George just walks in and picks it up. All the settings are the same and George plays the slide solo and there you go. So
and then
Mike
the other
Campbell
bit of
nearly a Wilbury.
Did he get a name? But of course the final bit of magic, you always need a bit of King Crimson, don't you, in these occasions?
Absolutely. We're working towards this King Crimson crossover. Yeah.
So Ian Wallace, who was in King Crimson in the early 70s, when around Islands Time, is it?
He was in there. That's it.
He does some drumming or some overdubbing of drumming, because Jeff's drumming can be a bit straightforward.
Yeah. The previous track was really Jeff and a drum machine. So Ian Wallace, by this stage, he was sort of pretty in-demand session drummer. And I think I'm pretty sure I saw Ian Wallace touring with Bob Dylan in 84. Bob Dylan personable at Slane, possibly. That was Ian Wallace, I think. So he comes in. He's also married to Jenny Boyd, Patty Boyd's sister.
So he's some kind of distant ex-in-law of George's.
He'd be like somewhere. an ex-brother-in-law or something. Yeah, George will have had some name for that.
So they've, you know, certainly after the second day, the song is finished and George puts it into his pocket, has it on a tape. And I guess the first person outside of the circle to hear it is Warner Brothers chief Mo Austin, who is obviously, you know, has been steering Cloud Nine to the success that it had, and he must, you know, have cartoon dollar bills in his eyes when he hears this song for the first time, because he's not keen on having it out as a B-side.
No, I mean, I can perfectly understand the ching of cash registers that he's hearing, because, and as I say, as soon as you have that vocal line from particularly from Roy Orbison, but they each have solo vocal lines, you think this can't possibly be a George Harrison song, and it cannot possibly be tucked away as the spare. It's not even the B-side, it's the third track on a single. So he immediately says, you know, no, we can't put this out. And this, according to Tom Petty, is the point at which the idea of a band suddenly appears. But we know that it's over a year since George had the name, had the guitar, had the merch, had the guitar picks, all of this. So this is, again, it would be interesting to find out if Mo Austin knew in advance that the recording session was taking place, you know, that had George sort of tipped him the wink that, you know, I'm going to try and get these guys together. And because again, they're all on different labels. So there is going to be, there are going to be contractual issues here.
It just, but it seems so, it seems so fanciful though, that if, you know, even like we were saying how, you know, the Rockland interview, they kind of glance over the Traveling Wilburys. But even if George said to Mo Austin, yeah, I'm going to put together a supergroup. In some ways, supergroups weren't fashionable at that time anyway. People weren't really calling out for them. And as we said, you know, there's this odd wobble of, you know, 60s acts trying to find their relevance in the mid 80s. So it mightn't have seemed like a winner on paper anyway, irrespective of how difficult it would have been to do. But and there's another world where George gets together with the four of them, records a B-side. It's not very good. And it just becomes a curio and a footnote that, hey, did you know this B-side has Bob Dylan on it? Blah, blah, blah. That that would be discussed on a different type of podcast. But, you know, there is definitely a bit of magic going on that, you know, there's the sports people call it in the zone. George is in the zone. He's having hits. Yep. He's having popularity. He's having a bit of a Midas touch, which he hasn't had in a little while. And when Mo Austin hears that song, I think it's the quality of the song itself that actually makes the thing happen.
I think that's true. That's true. And I mean, one of the things about Warner Brothers and about Mo Austin is they're, you know, Mo Austin famously came up with the rubric back in the day in the early 70s for Warner Brothers, which was let's stop trying to make hits. Let's just make good songs and turn those good songs into hits. You know, let's not follow slavishly what's happening. So Warner Brothers is a great kind of home for this type of thing. They kind of give artists the leeway. And this is the point at which I'm going to plug Sonic Boom. I don't know if you've read this book by Peter Ames Carlin. It's a fantastic book. It's not so much a music book as a book about the music business. Little bit of content. I'm not going to sell it as a Beatles book. There's a little bit of content about George and Mo Austin and this relationship, but it's a fantastic book. Very readable. Just about how you run a record business.
It's on my list. Yeah, Sonic Boom. I do intend to read it. And there's another interesting thing that's happening in the background here, which is Tom Petty is signed to MCA, and he's never really been particularly happy with his label. And Mo Austin is trying to snare Tom Petty. Tom Petty doesn't make the switch until Wildflowers in '94, but famously he signed his deal years in advance before Into the Great Wide Open came out, and actually even before Full Moon Fever came out. So Tom Petty is being sired by Mo Austin at this point as well. So he has that in his mind.
Yes. And supposedly what happened there, he signed that deal. And by the time sort of his existing contract ran out, the deal that he had signed with Warners was not particularly good in terms of royalty rates. So Mo Austin just renegotiated that for him.
Yeah, so, he just tore it up and said, I'll give you whatever you want.
Yeah. Warners have that, had that kind of ethos. Yeah. So
it's at this point when Mo Austin hears Handle With Care that, you know, finally the penny drops that, you know, it's like a test case, Handle With Care, that look, we know we can put these people together. We know we can create a good song. And according to Tom Petty, this is where George and Jeff decide to realize the band idea. And they phone Tom first, and then they phone Dylan, and Dylan agrees to join. So they've obviously all happy with the experience. Yeah. And then that night, George, Jeff and Tom go to Anaheim. These guys are really, they have a lot of free time to just do last minute things.
It's the life of a millionaire rock star. We'll get there one day.
I mean, like, really, if I was George's manager, he'd have been touring Cloud Nine into the ground. But anyway, Jeff, George and Tom go over to Anaheim to see Roy Orbison, who just happens to be performing in town at the Celebrity Theater, and they recruit him after what Petty describes as an extraordinary show. And they were all like little kids, excited that he's in our band and we can't believe
boys
it. And isn't
band,
it great?
Boys in our band.
I mean, that's fair enough.
Well, yeah, you know that there was a slight argument about what the band was going to be called.
Oh, really? Because, what were they? Was there a shortlist?
No. Dylan at one point was very, very insistent it should be called Roy and the Boys.
Well, again, that just goes to show Bob's, you know, deference to Roy. Yeah. Roy and the Boys would have been funny too. So, you know, they decide to just go for it. And so the next thing that they need to do is to get the dates down and get the location down and figure out how and when and why they're going to do it. And there's a couple of people involved in this, but everyone loves Dave Stewart, don't they?
They do.
Like he has
is he not the new Jeff Lynne?
He's sort of like he is a Jeff Lynne type figure, and certainly in the '80s, there is a Dave Stewart Tom Petty overlap, because when Tom was working on the album Southern Accents with the Heartbreakers, he went off one night with Dave Stewart, and on his own made up "Don't Come Around Here No More," yeah, which becomes this kind of signature mid-80s Tom and the Heartbreakers hit. And the Heartbreakers weren't particularly happy that it's Dave Stewart, and it's a bit different to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
It is a bit different. I do love that song and I do love the video, but it really punches a hole in the whole concept idea of that Southern Accents.
Oh yeah,
album.
Well, punches a hole is also what happened to Tom Petty during Southern Accents. Isn't that when he punched a hole in the wall, broke his hand, and the whole album went off the rails? But it is a great song, and Dave Stewart's in the video for "Don't Come Around Here No More," which Irish listeners will remember from MTUSA back in the day. But Dave Stewart is one of these, a bit like Jeff, one of these kind of laid-back emollients who doesn't mind sitting at a producer's desk for hours on end, doing all the dirty work and making everyone believe they're having a good time.
But there was a point where he was just producing everybody. You know, he was working with everybody in the way that Jeff did. So he sort of picked up a little bit, the jobs that Jeff couldn't take on, Dave was there.
So Dave Stewart offers his property. It's not really a studio, but it's basically an outhouse in the grounds of his mansion to record in.
The Bel Air mansion. Yeah, and if you've seen the little documentary that comes with the Wilburys sort of CD DVD set that came out, you know, it's a beautiful house from the outside, but inside it's pretty basic. And again, the engineer, I mean, you've got to feel sorry for these engineers. It was Don Smith, who was Tom Petty's regular engineer, who was in Montserrat with Keith Richards, got the call to come back because they had a 10-day window to record this album before Dylan, or at least to get Dylan's vocals and his contribution down, because he was going off on his never-ending tour, was just about to begin.
It is funny that this is the start of the never-ending tour. This was the last thing he did before the never-ending tour began. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Timeline-wise,
pretty much. I mean, Bob would say, "Oh, I should have the sleeve notes," but you know, he had things like the Temple in Flames tour was the one with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and then this just becomes known as the never-ending tour because he just doesn't stop.
Yeah.
But there are sleeve notes to an album where Dylan says that's not true, and he just lists all these ridiculous
tour names
for his tour names. But he's basically not stopped touring until the pandemic hit.
If you do watch that video documentary that comes to the Traveling Wilburys, there's a guy with his back turned in the documentary wearing an expensive Winos t-shirt the entire time.
Yes.
And I assume that's Don Smith, who's been pulled from the Keith Richards tour.
Yes.
The Keith Richards sessions. That must be him.
I suppose we're just lucky that Keith didn't get on the plane with him and gate crash the Wilbury sessions.
He might have derailed things a little bit because they have the location, which is the outhouse, the comfortable outhouse.
It's a very well appointed outhouse.
But you watched that video, they're recording in a kitchen and there's a separate kind of vocal booth and mixing desk room.
With carpets on the wall. So this guy, Don Smith, is saying nothing worked. So again, this is like nothing worked in Dylan's studio. Nothing works in Dave Stewart. He said we had to get carpets and hang them on the walls to sort of soundproof it. It was crazy.
So they have the location, they have the dates, which is 10 days in May 88, limited by the traveling of Bob Dylan. And they also tap the shoulder of Jim Keltner as well, who's going to get involved in the project on the drums because, we all know that Jeff loves a click track, but sometimes you need somebody to replace the click.
It
has to be a human being. And so they are all pointed in the right direction. They have their timeline and they're ready to go. And that's where we're going to press pause because, you know, we've still got a lot to talk about in terms of the Traveling Wilburys project, how they recorded, what they did next, and how it all rolls out. But we're going to discuss that in part two of our episode on the Traveling Wilburys. So, there's still a lot more road to travel with them, isn't there?
There is a lot. lot to learn. There's a lot to talk about.
So maybe in the meantime, you can go off and listen to your Traveling Wilburys records. We always want to drive you back to the records and discuss it online in the usual places, on Twitter at BeatlesPod, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, our website, www.nothingisrealpod.com, which has all the links to how to download, YouTube links, playlists, all sorts of fun stuff is there, and how to subscribe and support the podcast going forward. But for now, I'm Justin Wilbury.
I'm Perry Mason Wilbury.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.